This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Wishful Drinking by Carrie Fisher. Read by the author.
An abundance of apparently's. So I am 52 years old, apparently. Actually, that is more verifiable than the rest of it. I'd better start off with certainties. Here are the headlines. Head, in so many ways, being the operative word. I am 52 years old. I am Carrie Fisher. I have a daughter, Billy. I live in Los Angeles. I have two dogs. I have a really nice house. Carrie Fisher is apparently a celebrity of sorts. I mean, she's the daughter of famous parents, one an icon, the other a consort to icons. Actually, that's not completely fair. My father is a singer named Eddie Fisher, what was in the 50s called a crooner with many gold records. I only say my father is a consort because he's really better known for his not-so-private life than the life he lived on stage. His scandals outshone his celebrity. Or you might say that his scandals informed his celebrity in such a way as to make him infamous. My mother, Debbie Reynolds, was in what might be called iconic films, most notably Singing in the Rain. But for whatever reason, when my parents hooked up, it had an extraordinary impact on the masses who bought fan magazines. The media dubbed them America's sweethearts. The idea of them electrified. Their pictures graced the covers of all the tabloids of the day. They were adorable, and as such were ogled by an army of eyes. So cute and cuddly, and in some ways adorably average. The Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston of the late 50s, only slightly more so, because they actually managed to procreate, making two tiny children to fill out the picture, or pictures, as the case turned out to be, an all-American and photogenic family. When I was younger, starting at about 4, other children would ask me what it was like to be a movie star's daughter. Once I was a little older and understood, to a certain extent, the nature of what celebrity meant, I would say, compared to what? When I wasn't a movie star's daughter? When I lived with my normal, non-show business family, the regulars, Patty and Lowell regular of Scottsdale, Arizona? All I've ever really known is this sort of hothouse plant existence, and I could tell from watching how normal people live, normal people as depicted by Hollywood and burned into our consciousness, I understood that my life was unusual. Like many others, I grew up watching television shows like My Three Sons and The Partridge Family and The Real McCoys. And based on the lives depicted on those shows, I knew my life was a different sort of real. It was the only reality I knew, but compared to other folks, both on television and off, it eventually struck me as a little surreal, too. And eventually, too, I understood that my version of reality had a tendency to set me apart from others. And when you're young, you want to fit in. Hell, I still want to fit in with certain humans, but as you get older, you get a little more discriminating. Well, my parents were professionally committed to sticking out. So all too frequently, I found myself sticking out right along with them. Now, I'm certainly not asking anyone to feel bad for me or suggest that my existence could be described as a predicament of some kind. I'm simply describing the dynamic that was at work during my formative years. My parents were focus pullers, and when I say parents, I mean my mother, who raised me, and my father, who checked in from time to time. I mean, if I came into a room and said, You know how you saw your father more on TV than you did in real life? I don't think many people would say, oh my God, you too? And by the same token, I have to ask you, how often do you say in real life? Like real life is this other thing, and we're always trying to determine what's going on in this distant, inaccessible, incomprehensible place. What are they like in real life? That happened in real life? Really? Stuff like that. I am truly a product of Hollywood. You might say that I'm a product of Hollywood inbreeding. When two celebrities mate, something like me is the result. I grew up visiting sets and playing on backlots and watching movies being made. As a consequence, I find that I don't have what could be considered a conventional sense of reality. Not that I've ever had much use for reality, having spent much of my adult life attempting to escape it with the assistance of a variety of drugs. So as I said, my reality has been formed by Hollywood's version of reality. As a child, I thought that Father Knows Best was real and that my life was fake. When I think about it now, I may not have been far wrong. I tell you all of this as a newly made bystander, as I have been reintroduced into my world by electroconvulsive therapy, more commonly known as ECT, for those oh so fortunately familiar with it, and electroshock for those who are not. I've been reintroduced to my life at the ripe old age of 52. My memory, especially my visual memory, has been wrenched from me. All of a sudden, I find that I seem to have forgotten who I was before. So I need to reacquaint myself with this sort of celebrity person I seem to be. Someone who was in an iconic blockbuster film called Star Wars. How trippy is that? One thing I do recall is that one day, when I was a toddler, I sat planted closely to the television set, watching my mother in a movie called Susan Slept Here. And at a certain point, there's this scene where my very young mother tilts her face up to receive a kiss from Dick Powell. A kiss on the mouth. A romantic kiss. So she has her eyes closed, waiting. But instead of kissing her on the mouth, Mr. Powell bends down and kisses her on the forehead. And I sit there, registering this, and then look quickly over my shoulder to see if anyone else had seen what I saw. To see if I should be more embarrassed for my mother than I already was. I tell you this to illustrate that many times I didn't know the difference between movies and real life. In my life, they tend to overlap. Cary Grant, yes, the Cary Grant, became a family friend, even though he wasn't precisely that. And characters that my mother played in movies sometimes became confused with the person who was and is my mother. So, in a way, movies became home movies. Home became just another place on the movie star map. Later on, I worked out that my mother's appearance in the classic film Singing in the Rain was not completely unlike my own appearance in Star Wars. See, when she made that film, she was 19 and co-starred with two men. Well, I was also 19 when I made Star Wars and appeared opposite two men. How this is relevant, I have really no idea. I mean, maybe I was just grasping around for a sense of continuity. I emerge from my three-week-long ECT treatment to discover that I am not only this Princess Leia creature, but also several sizes of dolls, various t-shirts and posters, some cleansing items, and a bunch of other merchandise. It turns out, I swear, I was actually a kind of a pinup. A fantasy that geeky teenage boys across the globe jerked off to with some frequency. How's that for a newborn how-do-you-do damsel in very little cinematic distress? To wit, one afternoon in Berkeley, I found myself walking into a shop that sold rocks and gems. "Oh my God, aren't you?" the salesman behind the counter began. And before he could go any further, I modestly said, "Yes, I am." "Oh my God, I thought of you every day from when I was 12 to when I was 22, he said. And instead of asking what happened at 22, I said, "Every day?" He shrugged and said, "Well, 4 times a day. Welcome to the land of way too much information. On top of all the celebrity parents and Star Wars stuff, I apparently was once married to this brilliant songwriter, a rock icon of sorts. I mean, this is a man who wrote an array of beautiful songs, and even a few songs that were about me. How amazing is that? And get this, I'd always been a really big fan of his music. Huge. As a teen, it was just him and Joni Mitchell. And as I couldn't marry Joni, I married him. I loved this man's lyrics. They were one of the reasons I fell in love with words. I mean, how can you not love someone who writes, "Medicine is magical and magical is art. Think of the boy in the bubble and the baby with the baboon heart." Well, the answer for me was I couldn't. I couldn't not love him. I apprenticed myself to the best in him and bickered with the worst. And to top it off, we were almost the same size. I used to say to him, "Don't stand next to me at the party. People will think we're salt and pepper shakers." And wait till you hear this one. I've written 4 novels. Seriously. And 2 of them were even bestsellers. My first novel, Postcards from the Edge, was adapted into a film directed by Mike Nichols and starring Shirley MacLaine and Meryl Streep, basically playing a sometimes better, sometimes worse, dolled-up version of my mother and myself. I could go on and on, because there are certainly a lot of other cool things. I mean, the coolest being that I'm the mother of this amazing daughter named Billy. She's actually my most extraordinary creation. It occurs to me I might sound as though I'm boasting, and I promise you I'm not. It's just that ECT has forced me to rediscover what amounts to the sum total of my life. And, you know, I find a hell of a lot of it fills me with this kind of giddy gratitude. I mean, some of my memories will never return. They are completely lost, along with the crippling feeling of defeat and hopelessness. Not a tremendous price to pay when you think about it. Worth it! But now that we've established that I've had ECT, I have a list that I thought I'd share. A list of the electroshock treatment gang who have also apparently benefited from ECT. They may not have benefited from it, but they had it. I do this because I find that I frequently feel better about myself when I discover that we're not alone, you know, that there are, in fact, a number of other people who ail as we do, that there are actually a number of accomplished individuals who find it necessary to seek treatment for some otherwise insurmountable inner unpleasantness. I not only feel better about myself because these people are also fucked up, and I guess that gives us a kind of sense of extended community, but I feel better because look how much these fellow fuck-ups managed to accomplish. So, here are a portion of the folks with whom I share Electro Company. Judy Garland, Bill Styron, Sylvia Plath, Cole Porter, Lou Reed, Vivian Lee, Yves Saint Laurent, Connie Francis, Ernest Hemingway, Dick Cavett, Kitty Dukakis. I should also add that a lot of these people also show up in the Alcohol Addict lineup and Bipolar Crew, giving some of these multi-listers and myself the admirable distinction of having a trifecta score. Now, these fine folks are Bill Styron, Vivian Leigh, Frances Farmer, Sylvia Plath, Ernest Hemingway, Dick Cavett, Katie Dukakis, Yves Saint Laurent, and Cole Porter. Why did I feel I needed ECT? Well, it had been recommended by several psychiatrists over the years to treat my depression, but I couldn't bring myself to consider it as it seemed way too barbaric. My only exposure to it was Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which wasn't exactly an enticing example. From the seizures to the biting down on the stick to the convulsions, it looked traumatic, dangerous, and humiliating. I mean, what do we know for certain about it, right? Aren't there a bunch of risks? What if something goes wrong and my brain blows up? I'd been feeling pretty overwhelmed and defeated. I didn't necessarily feel like dying, but I'd been feeling a lot like not being alive. The second reason I decided to get ECT is I was depressed. I mean, profoundly depressed. Part of this could be attributed to my mood disorder, which was, in no doubt, probably the source of the emotional intensity. I mean, that's what can take simple sadness and turn it into sadness squared, right? It's sort of what revs up the motor of misery, guns the engine of an unpleasant experience, filling it with rocket fuel and blasting it into a place in the stratosphere that is oh so near something like a suicidal tendency. A place where the wish to continue living in this painful way is all but completely absent. So, when weighing the choice between ECT or DOA, the decision's pretty easy to make. Not only because of my daughter and the rest of my family, but for my formerly higher-functioning self. In the end, the choice couldn't have been easier to make. Electricity as opposed to game over. I decided to ride the lightning instead of extinguishing the light of life that had once shone out of my eyes. I keep my wick lit for my daughter, Billy, for my mother, my brother, for my entire family, and for each friend I've made with both hands, one heart, two moods, and a head once crammed with memory. Memory I must now reacquaint myself with. Perhaps now is as good a time as any to share with you the message that currently greets all callers on my answering machine, crafted by my friend Garrett. Hello, and welcome to Carrie's voicemail. Due to recent electroconvulsive therapy, please pay close attention to the following options. Leave your name, number, and brief history as to how Carrie knows you, and she'll get back to you if this jogs what's left of her memory. Thank you for calling, and have a great day. Each night, I do a show where I entertain with tales of my dysfunction. I've done the same show dozens of times in an assortment of cities, yet somehow, depending on the audience, it's always a little different. Adding myself to the dearth of damaged celebrities that seem compelled to share their tales of their time spent circling the drain. Wishful Drinking, both the show and the book, chronicles my all-too-eventful and, by necessity, amusing, Leia-laden life. I tell this story partly as a means to reclaim whatever I can of my former life, what hasn't been eaten by electroconvulsive therapy, and partly because I heard someone once say that we're only as sick as our secrets. If that's true, then this book will go a long way to rendering me amazingly well. Shores of Experience, Both Dark and Unfriendly. I have to start by telling you that my entire existence could be summed up in one phrase, and that is, if my life wasn't funny, it would just be true, and that is unacceptable. What that means is, well, other than what it sounds like, let's say something happens, and from a certain slant, maybe it's tragic, even a little bit shocking. Then time passes, and you go to the funny slant. And now, that very same thing can no longer do you any harm. So what we're really talking about then is location, location, location. An example of the tragic and shocking might be, 3 years ago, 10 months and 9 days, a friend of mine died in my house. But, not content to simply die at my house, he also died in my bed. So, he didn't just die in his sleep, he died in mine. Greg was one of my best friends, and he wasn't my boyfriend or anything. I mean, he didn't die in the saddle, which would have made me the saddle. No, Greg was gay, which could turn out to be something of a theme in this book. Now, if you entertain like I do, try to alert your guests not to do this. For two reasons, really. A, it's bad manners. And B, it tends to throw the host, or hostess, off their game a little bit. Like for a year or three. Now, I assume there might be some curiosity about this fairly exotic experience. And I know we don't know each other that well yet, but I promise you that's going to change drastically until some of you might actually feel the need to divorce me. And for that reason, we have lawyers standing by. But I promise you, you're not getting a dime. Or maybe you're not curious about this because you've woken up next to a corpse and therefore already know a lot more than anyone could possibly ever want to know about it. That, or maybe you don't want to know what it's like at all. I mean, it sounds unsavory and distasteful enough without the details. So, why dig deeper, you ask? I've actually found that a lot of people are curious about this whole business of a man dying in my bed. One of my favorite questions an audience member has asked me was, "How did you dispose of the body?" As if I dug a hole, put Greg in a bag, dragged him outside, and, well, you get the overall gist of my drift. Another favorite question is, were you naked? I haven't been naked in 15 years, and I haven't gone sleeveless in 20. Of course, sometimes people ask sensible questions like, what was he doing in your bed? Which is when I get to say, not much. But when they phrase it the other way, like, why was he in your bed, I'm forced to reply honestly. I tell them that it was Oscar time in Los Angeles, which is sort of like New Year's Eve for the vapid. And as my home is one of the centers of vapidity on the West Coast, Greg had flown out to L.A. to accompany me to the parties. He'd flown in from Bosnia, where he'd been running a presidential campaign. Because that's what Greg did. He ran presidential campaigns in unstable countries, like Republicans like to do. So he and his assistant Judy flew in to stay with me. Judy slept in the guest house, and I had another female friend who was gay also staying with us. So I had a choice. Sleep with the gay male friend or the gay female friend. I picked the gay male friend, and I was punished for it! I will never, ever do that again. Now, I've also been asked, what the hell was I doing in bed with a Republican? And in order to demonstrate my loyalty to the Democratic Party, I sometimes tell people that I may have slept with the Republican, but I've actually had sex with a Democratic senator. Of course, I'm then asked which senator, to which I reply, Chris Dodd. And the only reason I feel at liberty to blab about this indiscretion is that Senator Dodd spoke of our courtship that we engaged in those many thousands of years ago recently during his bid for the presidency. So when asked to elaborate on our courtship, Senator Dodd coyly replied, "Well, it was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away." I believe it was largely this comment that was responsible for his failure to win the nomination. You might also be wondering what caused Greg's death, other than his being a Republican. So I'll tell you. He died from a combination of sleep apnea, You know what that is, where you're maybe a little overweight and you sleep on your back and you're snoring and you suddenly stop breathing, right? It's kind of like you drown. So he died from sleep apnea and OxyContin use. Now, if you don't know what OxyContin is, it is a very strong painkiller that has the nickname OxyCoffin. But Greg wasn't just a Republican like a person who votes to the right. No, he was a Republican kind of like I was Princess Leia. He was a Republican by profession. Because how many gay Republican drug users do you know? Oh, that's right. Lots and lots. But Greg was really in on the ground floor of the whole gay Republican movement that's so prevalent in Washington today. The fact of the matter is, Greg was a lot of fun, especially for a Republican, and he had great stories. I mean, this is a guy who actually shared an office with Bush. But a long time ago, when W was just George Sr.'s son. So the two of them shared this little office. And Greg once told me, you know what Bush has as one of his many, many gifts? He can fart on command. Which is actually, if you think about it, in keeping with his jolly college good old frat boy persona. And Greg said that what Bush used to do was when Greg would be expecting a few people for a meeting, W would come in, fart in the office, and then run, leaving Greg in the middle of it. You know, like someone in a cloud of bad marijuana smoke. So the people Greg was meeting with would then come in and, of course, assume Greg was the author of this awful smell. It's not dissimilar to what President Bush has done to the country. At the time of Greg's death, my friend Dave said to me, honey, I know this is all just a gigantic pain in the ass. And I said, if I could isolate the pain just to my ass, it would be awesome. And Dave said, well, that's the meditation then. You know what's funny about death? I mean, other than absolutely nothing at all. You would think that we would be able to remember finding out that we weren't immortal. You know, sometimes I see children sobbing in airports and I think, oh, they've just been told. But no, we gradually somehow just seem to have been able to absorb the blow. Blow, not being the operative word, Greg did do quite a bit of that, just not on this particular evening. Anyway, enough about death. I just wanted to get that bummer story out of the way at the top of the book. It's over now. All the rest of my stories are fun and laughs and skipping. Scandal outshining celebrity. So now, will you guys come on a journey with me? Okay? We're going to start at death, but then we're going to double back. And we're going to go all the way through an emergency room where they know me, through Watergate, through Vietnam, to birth. My birth. I was born on October 21st, 1956. This makes me quite old, half a century and change. And I was born in Burbank, California. To simple folk. People of the land. Now, actually, my father was a famous singer. And you want to hear something really cool? My mother's a movie star. Seriously. She's like an icon. A gay icon, but, you know, you take your iconic stature where you can get it. His name is Eddie Fisher, and her name is Debbie Reynolds. Now, my parents had this incredibly vital relationship with an audience, you know, like with muscle and blood, and this was the main competition that I had for my parents' attention. An audience. People like you. You know who you are. My father had many big hit songs, but perhaps the one he's best remembered for was the song Oh My Papa, which I like to call Oh My Faux Pas. And my mother, well, she did tons and tons of films, but I think maybe the one she's best remembered for is the classic film Singing in the Rain. But She was also nominated for an Oscar for Best Actress for her role in The Unsinkable Molly Brown. But tragically, she lost to Julie Andrews for her stunning, layered, and moving portrait of Mary Poppins. Ibsen's Mary Poppins, of course. My mother was also in another film called Tammy, which was also a hit song, which really pissed my father off because that was his area. She was actually pregnant with me when she filmed Tammy. So if you look very closely, there's a scene where she and Leslie Nielsen are trying to save some prize tomatoes in a rainstorm, like they do in old movies. Well, I'm the bulge in the side of her abdomen. It's some of my best screen work, so I urge you to see it. Oh, and she was also pregnant with me in yet another film called A Bundle of Joy, co-starring that marvelous method actor, Eddie Fisher. When I was born, my mother was given anesthesia, because they didn't have epidurals in those days. I always thought they should make epidurals that worked from the neck up, which was a condition I aspired to for most of what I laughingly refer to as my adult life. Anyway, so my mother was unconscious. Now, my mother is a beautiful woman. I mean, she's beautiful today in her 70s, so at 24, she looked like a Christmas morning. So all the doctors were buzzing around her pretty head, going, "Oh, look, there's Debbie Reynolds, how pretty, asleep." And my father, upon seeing me start to come through, you know, crowned with all the placenta and everything else, my father faints dead away. So now all the nurses go, "Oh, look, there's Eddie Fisher, the crooner, on the ground. Let's go look at him." So when I arrived, I was virtually unattended. And I have been trying to make up for that fact ever since. Even this book is a pathetic bid for the attention I lacked as a newborn. My father was best friends with a very charismatic producer named Mike Todd. Mike Todd produced a film called Around the World in 80 Days, which won an Oscar for Best Picture. So my father and mother, Mike Todd, his fiancée, who happened to be Elizabeth Taylor, they went everywhere together, you know. They went to nightclubs and on cruises. They literally traveled the world. So when Mike and Elizabeth got married, my father was Mike Todd's best man, and my mother was Elizabeth's matron of honor. She even washed her hair on her wedding day. Now, later I heard my mother mumble she wished she'd washed it with Nair. She's not a bitter woman. Anyway, I was about 2 when my brother was born, and my father so adored Mike Todd that my brother Todd was named for him. Now, perhaps not realizing that in the Jewish faith, it is considered bad luck to name a newborn after someone who is still living. A silly superstition. Or so they thought. Because about a year later, Mike Todd took off in a private plane in a rainstorm. And the following morning, Elizabeth was a widow. Well, naturally, my father flew to Elizabeth's side, gradually making his way slowly to her front. He first dried her eyes with his handkerchief, and then consoled her with flowers. And ultimately, he consoled her with his penis. Now, this made marriage to my mother awkward. So he was gone within the week. And as far as I know, he has not returned. Up to this very day. But you know what? I have high hopes for the run of my show. Because I think one night, they're both going to come to the show on the same night, run into each other, get that old feeling, get back together, and raise me right. Now, some of you might be thinking, well, that explains it. She's the product of Hollywood inbreeding. That's why my skull isn't entirely grown together at the back. Recently, my daughter, Billy, who's 16 now, she had a flirtation with Mike Todd and Elizabeth's grandson, Reese. And when they first met, They were trying to work out how it all fit together, you know, and if they were related in any way. So I thought about it. Now, when I think, I need this enormous chalkboard with a chart to hold my thoughts because I have so many zooming this way and that. And then it's also helpful if I can have some pictures and a pen so I can organize the insanity that is my thought process and my family. Welcome, class, to Hollywood 101. Thank you so much for enrolling. All right, so over here at the top left of the chart, we have Eddie and Debbie. In the 50s, they were known as America's sweethearts. Now, for those of you that are too young to relate to any of this, try to think of it this way. Think of Eddie as Brad Pitt, Debbie as Jennifer Aniston, and Elizabeth as Angelina Jolie. Does that help? That should help. All right. So, Eddie consoles Elizabeth with his penis. Elizabeth takes a movie in Rome, big budget film called Cleopatra. She meets her co-star, Richard Burton. So, goodbye, Eddie. Hello, Richard. These two hit it off like gangbusters, whatever that means, and they met and they married. They had a wild, passionate relationship with violet eyes and Welsh accents and acting and diamonds and drinking and dancing and sex and joy and love. But it was a passionate relationship, and those can become stormy. So then what do you think happens? That's right. They get divorced. But they have good memories of each other. So what do you think they do then? They remarry. That's right. Now, keep that in mind, because it might come up again. All right, so now let's go to Debbie. Now, Debbie does not want to marry another man who'll just run off. So, she marries someone very, very old, who can't run. No, Harry Carl can't run at all. He just sits in a chair, and he smokes, and he drinks, and reads the paper. And after about 13 years, he loses all his money, and then he takes all of hers. Fun! And so they got divorced, and she was alone for a while. But then fate intervened and brought her this sociopath, Richard Hamlet, who also had money issues. Her money. But let's not get too far past stepfather number one, Harry Carl. Now, Harry was a shoe tycoon. Doesn't sound like those words should fit together, does it? But in this case, they do. So, prior to being married to my mother, Harry was married to Marie MacDonald. Marie, the body MacDonald, as she was known. Now, Marie was an actress-ish. And she and Harry met, and they married, and they had a wild, passionate relationship with shoes and bodies and drinking and dancing and lust and joy and fun. But here come those storm clouds, so what do you think they do then? Yep, that's right, they divorce. But they have good memories of each other, so now what do? That's right, they remarry! And now they had that great American institution. They have makeup sex, which, as everyone knows, is the best sex of all. And to celebrate the good sex, they do it in the usual way. They have a child. And that goes so well, they adopt two more. But, uh-oh, here come those storm clouds. So they... yep, they divorce. Now, Marie MacDonald was a very romantic, optimistic woman. And I say this because she married a grand total of 9 times, which is a record for the board, and that is saying something because this is a marrying board. Now, that many marriages could give you a headache, no? Well, I think it gave Marie one because she became addicted to painkillers. Now, recently, I heard this amazing thing. If you become addicted to painkillers, it can turn out to go very, very wrong for you. Who knew that? Anyway, it did go wrong with Marie because she ended up overdosing and passing on. And that last husband, not to be outdone, shot himself. You might say they loved each other to death. So, now there are these three children left. What should we do with them? I know. Let's send them to Harry and Debbie. Now, Debbie is told that one of these children should be institutionalized. But my mother is a good person, much like Sarah Palin, only smarter. And she says, absolutely not. We will put the institutionalizable one in Carrie's room. Sure, it's funny now. So now let's go to Eddie. Poor Eddie. How do you follow an act like Elizabeth Taylor? Well, he manages somehow. He pulls something together. He meets a blonde, cute, perky little actress. Sound familiar? No, it's not Debbie again. It's a tribute to Debbie. It's Connie Stevens. So they meet, and they have Jolie Fisher from the sitcom Till Death and Trisha Fisher from New York. Oh, wait a second. Did Eddie forget to marry Connie? He did. He forgot to marry her. But eventually he remembers, so they get married. But, as many, many people know, legal sex is just shite compared to the premarital stuff that I know so many couples have had in cars. So, they divorce. But don't worry, Eddie's not alone for long, because now he meets and marries Miss Louisiana! Yeah, she's 3 years older than I am, and she calls me dear, which I love. I love it. Now, I thought this relationship would go on and on and on because, you know, Miss Louisiana's in her early 20s, and Eddie's in his late 50s, so she had so many years to devote to him. But what do you think happens? Yep, they divorce. I was stunned. But don't worry, he's not alone for long, because now he meets and marries this really lovely woman named Betty Lin. Betty is from China, and she takes fantastic care of my father, and believe me, he needs it. And she's the same age as Eddie, which hasn't happened since the Debbie and Liz stuff. And the other good thing about Betty is that she's rich. Which is handy because Eddie's gone bankrupt 4 times by now. So they're happy for 10, 15 glorious years. But then what do you think happens? That one's actually a trick question because they don't divorce. Betty passes away. It was sad. But don't worry. He's not alone for long. 'Cause now my father dates all of Chinatown. He does this partly as a tribute to Betty, partly because my father has had so many facelifts that he looks Asian himself. So it's more right that way. You know, they're more like a match set. Okay, so now let's recap. Eddie and Debbie have me and my brother Todd. I grow up, sort of, and I marry Paul Simon. Now, Paul is a short Jewish singer, and Eddie Fisher is a short Jewish singer. Any questions? My mother makes a blueprint, and I follow it to the letter. So Paul and I have a passionate relationship with lots of words, big words, clever words. Uh-oh, the words get mean. So now we get divorced. But don't worry, I'm not alone for long. 'Cause now I meet Brian Lord. Brian is a talent agent, so fewer words, great sex, we celebrate and we have a child together, Billy Lord. Elizabeth and Mike Todd have Liza Todd. Liza is a wonderful sculptress, and she meets and marries her art professor, Professor Hap Tivy. Hap is short for happy, so he's not Jewish. Anyway, they have Quinn Tivy and Reese Tivy. So, Rhys Tivy and Billy Lord. Are they related? You can peek back at the chart if you haven't already. I told them you're related by scandal. I just hope the two of them marry someday so all this will be worthwhile. And that is Hollywood inbreeding. Hollywood inbreeding is a little like royal inbreeding. And after all, celebrity is sort of like American royalty. So my brother and I are like those sad, sad royal inbred cases, like King Charles II of Spain, the last of the Habsburgs. Charles, now this man was so horribly inbred that his aunt was also his grandmother. And his tongue was so large that he couldn't chew, couldn't be understood, and he drooled. Another little challenge for Charles was that his organs were dying inside his body. The one on the outside didn't work that well either, because he died childless. But because his organs were dying, he smelled. So the people around him would put this perfume on him when he met prospective wives. And by the way, we do sell that perfume out in the lobby at my show. Now, another issue for Charles was he had these little seizures all the time, and he would fall over. So the perfume people put weights in his shoes. Anyway, it worked, because Charles actually managed to marry twice. Probably someone with nursing ambitions, which goes to show you that there is a lid for every pot. Sometimes there's as many as 9 lids for the same pot. Also, when I was a teenager, you could buy pot in lids. But I don't think you can anymore, can you? Oh, and Charles's death caused the War of the Spanish Succession, which I know a lot of you have been discussing at length recently. So my brother and I grew up smelling and drooling and having seizures, and we did all this in our house, which I called the embassy, because really it looks a lot less like a house than a place where you'd get your passport stamped. Where would you put a Christmas wreath on something like that? So it was a modern house, and it had things most normal houses don't have. For example, we had 8 little pink refrigerators, you know, in case Snow White and the 7 dwarves came by. And we had a lanai and utility closets. Oh, and we had 3 pools, you know, in case 2 broke. Now, there was also my mother's closet, which I always thought of as the Church of Latter-day Debbie. There was a certain hush, a certain smell of Abilene cream and White Shoulders perfume. It was very, very dark and very quiet, and it was subject to its own laws. Sort of like the phone booth where Clark Kent was transformed into Superman. My mother's closet was the magical place that she entered as my mom and emerged as Debbie Reynolds. Her closet was huge, like an enormous room, with an entrance and an exit, and it was lined on each side by every sort of clothes. Gowns, slacks, blouses, shoes, and hat boxes, all manner of attire imaginable, and even the unimaginable. I remember she had all these long, pale gowns made out of beads. One in particular was this blue gown that shimmered with blue beads, and it even had blue fur on the sleeves and on the hem. So she'd float through a room in these movie star gowns. Then there was this long, shimmery white chest of drawers where she kept all of her underwear and bras and slips and stockings, all neatly folded up and smelling of sachet. She had this weird giant underwear that went over her belly button. Big underpants and huge bras. I remember thinking, oh, wow, someday when I'm grown up, maybe I'll get my own enormously big breasts. I used to watch while my mother lifted up her huge fun bag so she could wash underneath them. Eventually, I actually did get those big breasts, and now I am truly, truly sorry. My mother's closet wasn't off limits, but it was very much hers, and therefore my younger brother Todd and I valued it. It was prized because of how highly we prized our mother. She was often away, and when we missed her, we could go into her closet and put our faces into a bunch of clothes and inhale the powdery, flowery scent of her. We would put shows on together in the closet, making some kind of airplane game or restaurant game. And then there was this hat that we for some reason called the bum-bum hat. It was this giant straw hat with a brim that continued on over your eyes so you could look out of this green mesh. We loved nothing more than to put on the bum-bum hat and look through the green mesh at our suddenly transformed surroundings. My mother was magnificent when she was decked out in all her glory, when she was ablaze with all manner of jewelry and gems and shimmering diamond earrings and her neck encircled with bright stones that caught the light, and a gown with matching shoes and stockings and makeup, and her tall wig carefully coiffed by her hairdresser Sidney Gilleroff, or Uncle Sidney, as we were encouraged to call him. Sidney's name could be found in the credits of some of the more classic MGM films of all time. My mother would emerge from her dressing room a vision, so glamorous and so not of this world. When my mom was home on weekends, we stayed with her as much as possible, which frequently meant that we were very involved in watching our mother. Right next to her closet, there was this huge bathroom with magenta marble and mirrors everywhere, and I remember the smells of her perfume, the L'Air du Temps or the creams like Pons or Abilene. And on the bathtub, there were always two or three monogrammed face cloths laid out with her initials, DRK, Debbie Reynolds Carl. And then there was the Shrine of the Wigs, which was at the end of one countertop, along with what seemed to me like hundreds and hundreds of lipsticks, eyebrow pencils, and false eyelashes. My mother was unbelievably meticulous at all of this. She would twirl her hair up into pin curls that she'd use to pull her face tighter. Then she'd put on her makeup base with a sponge. The base went really low when the dress was low cut, which it often was. Then she applied false eyelashes. So she didn't need mascara, but there was a lot of eyeliner. Next came lipstick and rouge and powder, great puffs of glittering clouds of powder, followed by hair, which was a big deal getting the wig on right. Then came the earrings, and then she'd step into her clothes. Then came her stockings and her tiny little size 5 shoes. When she was completely finished, her Debbie Reynolds movie star accent got stronger. Her posture got better, and she looked incredibly beautiful. When our mother dressed, the man behind the curtain became the great and powerful Oz. Undressing was also a process my brother and I observed. First, we'd watch my mother as she removed her makeup with a washcloth. Then she'd take a bubble bath. As Todd and I looked on, Debbie Reynolds would slowly return to being our mother. The coach was once more a pumpkin. The footman went back to being mice. Pinocchio became a real girl. We loved to be with her when she resumed her role as our mother. That this amazing being who looked like she looked and had these remarkable abilities belonged to us somehow. She was so beautiful. And, of course, I dreamt of one day looking like her. I fantasized that perhaps if Uncle Sidney would put my mother's tall golden wig on my head and give me her perfectly coiffed hairstyle, then I would transform into the confident and shining beauty I would surely be. Soon I would be beautiful too. But to my horror, no such transformation occurred. It was then that I knew with the profound certainty of a 10-year-old that I would not be, and was in no way now, the beauty that my mother was. I was a clumsy-looking and intensely awkward, insecure girl. I decided then that I'd better develop something else. If I wasn't going to be pretty, maybe I could be funny or smart. Someone past caring. So far past caring that you couldn't even see it with a telescope. Sometimes my mother would take me shopping, to Saks Fifth Avenue, or a store called Pixie Town. But when I was a little girl, and even sometimes now, it was complicated to go out in public with my mother because she was so famous. She belonged to the world. She not only looked like Debbie Reynolds, but to make matters worse, she wore this giant diamond ring. It was like being in a parade. In a way, my mother was an event. "Oh, my God," people would say to her, "I loved you in Molly Brown," or "I saw you in Vegas." So it was not like having private time with Mom. And I really didn't like sharing her. It seemed almost unsanitary. When my mother was home, she did a lot of sleeping because she worked so hard and had such long hours. So Todd and I wanted as much of her company as we could get. I slept on the rug on the floor next to her bed, and my brother slept on the couch near the window. In the morning, when Todd and I got up, we would creep softly out of her room so we wouldn't wake her. Our house was very cold, with lots of marble and white couches that were all puffed up, and glass coffee tables and white rugs with plastic on the corners to protect them. Everywhere were things we could ruin, so we didn't want to screw up and make the puffed-up couch deflate or leave marks on the glass tabletops. It was complicated to find a groovy place to hang out in. We usually ended up hanging out in the kitchen. That's where it felt the homiest. Now, my stepfather, Harry Carl, was not a handsome man, but because he was wealthy and well-groomed, he was said to be distinguished-looking. That's ugly with money. They actually made a movie about Harry Carl and Marie McDonald and their multiple marriages. It was called The Marrying Man, and Alec Baldwin played Harry Carl. And I think the resemblance is astonishing. Harry had his own room with a closet that was pristine and beige. We had a laundress named Letha, who came in once a week to do Harry's shirts. His shirts were monogrammed, and he also had monogrammed slippers and silk paisley pajama tops and a lot of neat gray suits. There was one of those black and red things that twirl around and shine your shoes, and a secret drawer to hide his gold coins, and a wooden coat rack to put his jackets on. He also had a man named Phil Kaplan, who helped him dress. And then there was a barber and manicurist who came in to help him get distinguished looking. But the most unique room we had was on the way to the projection room. It was sort of like an exercise room, but what stopped it from being an exercise room was that it had a barber chair in the middle of it. We found out later that the barber who came every day turned out to be a pimp with a talent for hair, and for those of you with pimps, you know that they usually can't do hair for shit. So the manicurists that the barber brought with him every day, they were probably doing more of a French manicure, don't you think? The word hangnail comes to mind. My mother, on the other hand, did everything for herself. She was an incredibly energetic human and could be unbelievably fun. Harry, though, was not fun. Not deliberately, anyway. But he did get out of bed wearing just